Hello, this time on Sit Rep.
It's official. It's all over. It's total victory.
80 years since the surrender of Japan brought an end to World War II, we focus on the key role of one extraordinary British military leader, how he turned defeat into victory, the lessons from his failures and successes, and why he's widely regarded as Britain's greatest general.
Oh, General Slimwee was marvellous. We had great faith in him, one of the best leaders we could probably have out in the jungle.
He was actually unable to go to the sword surrender. He thought the Japanese had behaved disgracefully towards prisoners, etc., and he could think of no better insult than not to turn up for the ceremony.
Sit Rep
with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
Mike, we already know you're a big fan of General Bill Slim. Of course, he ended his career as Field Marshal Slim. You have mentioned him a lot in our conversations on Sit Rep, haven't you? But can you actually remember when you first became aware of him and his significance?
Personally, it was not until relatively recently in my academic life, because like most people, I took an interest in the Second World War, mainly war in the West, and my own family connections are all to the war in the West and, you know, Battle of Britain and D-Day and all that sort of thing. And to be honest, I only really got to get interested in Bill Slim, I don't know, about 30 years ago, probably, when I read George MacDonald Fraser. His book, you know, he was the author of the Flashman novels, and his wonderful book called Quartered Safe Out Here. And it's his reminiscences of being a member of the Border Regiment. And he was in the Battle of Mactila and the attack on Mandalay. And he doesn't say much about Bill Slim in that book because it's a personal memoir. But what he does say is so affecting that when I read Quartered Safe Out Here, I thought, gosh, what a general. Mm. And I began to get really interested in Bill Slim after that. And I've been passionately interested in him since then, really.
And I love the way, Mike, you say only 30 years ago. That's not bad going, let's say. We'll hear later from a Burma veteran about his experiences under General Slim's command. Also, Bill Slim's grandson, the current Viscount Slim, shares some very rare and unique insights. But let's bring in two more fans of Bill Slim, historian, author and filmmaker Phil Craig. His most recent book is 1945, The Reckoning, and military historian Dr. Robert Lyman, who served for 20 years in the British Army and who successfully argued the case for Bill Slim as Britain's greatest general at the National Army Museum in 2011, although Slim did hold first place in the poll jointly with Wellington. Welcome to both of you. Great to have you on Sit Rep today.
Thank you.
Robert, what is it about Slim that makes him so great? Is it purely his achievements? Is it the man himself? Or is it something more intangible than that?
It's two things. First is that he was a great soldier. He understood what soldiering required. He loved soldiers. He loved soldiering itself. He was, you know, the epitome of a really good soldier. That's the first thing to understand. You can't be a great tactician and a great strategist and achieve great things in war unless you really understand who you're dealing with, both on your side and on the enemy side. But in addition to that, he was a really good tactician. I would say he was very good at the operational level of war. He knew how to fight wars. He knew how to identify the enemy's weaknesses and to exploit them. So there was really good stuff about him, his personality and his ability to understand soldiers. But there was also a very significant part about how he thought about war fighting.
And Phil, having just written a book length account of the end of the war in Asia and its results, how important an historical figure is Bill Slim and all of that?
Hugely. Michael mentioned Quartered Safe Out Here, which, of course, I think I'm sure we've all read. And I think the thing about Slim that you get from that book is just the confidence he gave his men, the sense that he cared for them, that he was there for them, that he was with them. And I think the thing that we haven't touched on yet, which I think maybe is a secret of his success, is that he didn't just re-equip an army, he remoralized an army. I mean, this was a beaten army. This was 1942 is one of the great British defeats of the Second World War. It just about holds together, but it's kind of a jungle Dunkirk. They're clinging on by their fingertips. And there's a sense that their enemy is somehow invincible, that their enemy has this strange, almost biological connection to the jungle, and that we, the British or the Indians, we're all at sea, we're lost. We can't fight this kind of war against these kind of men. And by a series of brilliant tactical innovations, by an incredibly, incredibly rigorous training program, which the Auchinleck also plays a big part in, this army is turned around. And I think turning around a defeated army into a war-winning machine, so that by the time we get to quartered safe out here, those guys, they don't think they're going to lose. And that's an amazing achievement for any general, I think.
Yes, Phil's absolutely right. But we need to remember that nearly 90% of his soldiers were African and Indian. And the fact that he was able to create a relationship with Indian soldiers and that they followed him, this whole idea of Bill Slim being Uncle Bill was actually a Hindi phrase, Chacha Slim Saab, that came from his Indian soldiers rather than his British soldiers. And that's a really, really powerful dimension to this story.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit later on in this edition. And if there is one illustration of Bill Slim's historical importance, it is his presence at Japan's formal surrender in Singapore. Now, we know this because we've seen the seating plan for the signing ceremony. His grandson, Viscount Mark Slim, has just given our BFBS Forces News colleague Tim Cooper a very rare guided tour of some of the artefacts that the family have from his career.
That is the seating plan, with all the Japanese generals lined up here and all the Allied commanders down here. Slim is sitting opposite Kimura, and that is my grandfather's nameplate badge, which he obviously took home with him after the session. All the Allied commanders have signed the seating plan, and that is the pen that the treaty was, well, the surrender was signed with. I was completely overawed. I'd opened a piece of history, which I may have been told about when I was younger, but I'd completely forgotten about. And I immediately took it down to a framer, and it's now in museum quality frame because I think it's an important part of history. The sword is General Kimura's sword. He was the commander of the Japanese Imperial Army during the Battle of the Irrawaddy Shore and on the eventual victory in Rangoon. It's a battle sword, it's not a ceremonial sword, so it's been used in battle, and it's still incredibly sharp, so do not touch it. And it's got chips where it's obviously killed people and taken bits of bone with it. So it's, I think, without question, my grandfather's proudest possession.
And how did he end up with that sword?
Well, it wasn't actually surrendered directly to him. I think he was actually unable to go to the sword surrender and sent a deputy who handed it to him later. The story put about was that he thought the Japanese had behaved disgracefully towards prisoners, etc., and he could think of no better insult than not to turn up for the ceremony.
Those really are quite staggering artifacts there.
That name card looked like it had been written by a child on a crayon. I mean, it was. They firstly couldn't afford a printer in those days. That was, I mean, amazing. I mean, to have been there, extraordinary.
They're incredibly moving. They're a direct connection with the past. Being able to see Kimura's sword, being able to see the seating plan, and actually going to Singapore and walking around the room in which the surrender took place is incredibly moving.
Yeah, it's interesting. Kimura, I mean, the whole thing became, in the offensive after Kohima and Imphal, it almost became a personal battle between Bill Slim and Kimura. And some of his critics at the time said, look, this is a private war. I mean, he was exceeding his brief from Whitehall. I mean, he wasn't supposed to be attacking. He was supposed to be just holding the line until they had more amphibious craft to launch a big amphibious operation against Rangoon. And Slim realised that he was going to have to do this the hard way and slog through the jungle from the Naga Hills right down to Rangoon. And he wasn't prepared to sit idly. He wasn't prepared to just hold the line. And there was enough elbow room, enough wiggle room in his orders to allow him to do that. And his critics, who didn't like the idea that he did that, they said, look, he's just taking on a personal vendetta against Kimura. And in a way, he had, because that's what you do. You work out your commander, the commander you're opposing, and you work out how to oppose him. And to be honest, Kimura, when it came to the Battle of Mandalay, Mektila, I mean, Kimura didn't know what was going to happen next. He was completely bamboozled by Slim because of Slim's tactics were so good and so flexible and successful that it really was a bit of a personal struggle. So that sword and the seating plan, where he was sitting opposite Kimura, that must have given him some satisfaction.
One of the great things about Slim was that he was an ordinary soldier, an ordinary person. He represented the ordinary soldiers, and you know what, ordinary soldiers recognize that. And what we saw in Burma was the triumph of ordinary soldiers, ordinary Brits, ordinary Indians, in overcoming a really, really dramatic challenge to democracy and to the stability of the world. But I think one of the challenges that we have is to remember why this victory was so important in 1945 and who secured it. It was a people's war, and people's generals won this war for us. And that's why we need to remember it.
I think the one of the characters I write about, Rob's already mentioned the importance of the many, many thousands of Indian volunteers in Slim's army. One of the people I write about is a man called Colonel Timmy, who becomes chief of staff of the Indian Army after independence. He goes to Singapore for that ceremony. And I think they all felt that it wasn't just the end of a war, it was the beginning of a new world.
Yes.
That they'd fought for. And some of the people are fighting for maybe quite complicated reasons. Certainly by the end, I think a lot of the Indian soldiers thought they were fighting as much for independence as they were for beating the Japanese. And of course, perhaps the one thing couldn't happen without the other. But don't forget, they were also fighting other Indians who had allied themselves with the Japanese. So the story of the campaign in Burma is a story of two Indian armies, one bigger than the other, but it's just politically rather significant. Certainly when they went to Singapore, they were thinking this is the beginning of a new world.
You were completely in agreement with this idea of the beginning of a new world, Robert.
Definitely. Absolutely right. I mean, it's very, very interesting. People could feel it in 1945 that they were fighting to remove an impediment to a new world based on the Atlantic Charter. This is really, really important. I think we've forgotten this today. In 1941, Roosevelt and Churchill agreed, much against Churchill's inclinations, I think, but they agreed a set of principles that framed the future world, which allowed people of every nation to choose their own governments. And of course, that's all fine and dandy in a democracy, but what about the colonies? What about India? And Indians were talking about this through 1942 through to 45, saying, well, we want to have a part of this as well. And soldiers, ordinary soldiers, were joining the Indian Army to fight the Japanese. And I've interviewed many, many Japanese soldiers who've told me this, in order to be able to present a new world in which they could achieve independence. Not independence at the end of a gun, but an amicable separation, a parting of the ways with Britain. And that was achieved. And I think that's the great triumph of 1945. It's the great triumph of the defeat of the Japanese, that the Japanese effectively were trying to impose another form of totalitarianism on Asia. And that was rejected by Asians.
So we'll cover the how in a bit, but let's focus in on what Bill Slim did that contributed to victory over Japan. Mike, can you just give us a very potted history of Bill Slim's campaign? He summed it up in three words on the cover of his memoirs: defeat into victory.
Yes. I mean, he's brought into the campaign as a corps commander when the British or the Burma army is withdrawing, longest withdrawal in British military history, 1,000 miles up to Tambu on the Indian border. Complete defeat, as Robert said. I think it was a sort of Dunkirk. And the soldiers that he brought in, he was in charge of the rear guard. The soldiers he brought in, he said they were like scarecrows when they got to Tambu, but they were still in their units and they still had their weapons with them. And his army of scarecrows cheered him loudly when they paraded a couple of days later. And he was baffled by that, because it was a defeat. But he learned from that. And he was given the 14th Army, he was given the Eastern Army, and renamed it the 14th Army in November 1943. And, I mean, he basically, unlike many generals, I mean, he made the army. I mean, Wellington did the same in the peninsula. General Grant did the same in the American Civil War, made an army and then fought it. David Petraeus has done it in the modern era, done it twice, you know, built a force and then fought with it in two campaigns. But it's very unusual for a general to create an army and then fight it. But that's exactly what Bill Slim did. And he created an army that was exactly right for the battles that he wanted to fight. And so the big campaign really started late 1943. The first big victory is in 1944, the defense of Kohima and Imphal that stops the Indian attack into India. And that then leads on to this big open campaign to retake Rangoon, which he finally does in 1945, just as the war in Europe is coming to an end. So the great victories of the 14th Army were always overshadowed by the bigger events that seemed to be going on with the Normandy invasion and the surrender of Germany through from the autumn of 1943 to the summer of 1945.
And to add to that, Phil, the very quick view that many people have is that the US and two atomic bombs were responsible for victory over Japan. Why did Bill Slim's eventually successful campaign matter?
I believe it was the biggest land victory over any Japanese force in the Second World War. I mean, we all know about the Pacific Island campaigns, how very difficult and brutal they were, but the numbers of men involved were relatively small compared to the Japanese army and its INA associates fighting in the Indian Burma and Burma. What Michael said is absolutely right. On the tactical level, I mentioned training and the idea that you can remoralize and give an army hope by giving it new tactics and a new vision. And I think one of the first signs of that happens in the admin box battle in Arakan, which is before Imphal and Kohima. They start fighting in a different way. Some of this has been learned from the Australians and their experiences in New Guinea. It's about the use of tanks. It's about the use of airdropped supplies. But it's also psychological. In the first campaigns of this war, the Japanese were always going behind British lines, and that caused panic. And rushed withdrawals to a new line, this obsession with a line. But what Slim and others were able to inculcate in these men is, well, if the Japanese go around you, certainly in a jungle environment, in a sense, they're cutting themselves off. You can stay where you are and just keep fighting. And if we can supply you from the air, then it's the Japanese who will soon find themselves without supplies. And supplies are critical in this kind of battle space. So, yeah, they rethought how they could fight them. And the confidence then just grew and grew and grew. In terms of the overall victory over Japan, of course, the firebombing of the Japanese cities and then the nuclear attacks were the final act. But I don't think that happens anything like as soon without the victories of the British-led army in Burma.
I just want to make a couple of points that I think are also really important for us to remember today. It was important for victory in Burma was very important for two groups of people. The first were the Indians, who were able to see the triumph of the Indian army defeating an Asian enemy on their doorstep and protecting India. That's really important as the development of independence grows in the months and years that follow. But secondly, it's really important to demonstrate to the Japanese people that the bubble of militarism had been burst. The military in Japan had been trying to tell the Japanese people for decades that through military means alone, their empire would be created and Japan would be seen as great around the world. This had been demolished. This whole idea was demolished by the defeat of their armies in the field, most notably by Burma. And it removed the idea that the Japanese were forced to surrender as a result of the atomic bombs only. This is a really important thing, and I've come across this time and time again in Japan, interviewing Japanese people. They realise that their militarism was a busted flush.
Mm. And before we talk about how he turned defeat into victory, it is worth understanding a bit more about General Slim, the man. Mike, he was from a fairly humble background, and that made his rise to the top really quite unusual.
Yes, and I mean, he was seriously wounded. First of all, in the Gallipoli campaign, as a young officer, and then seriously wounded again in Mesopotamia and then in Africa. I mean, he was somebody who had lived through campaigns and failed campaigns as a young officer. He was somebody who, as a mid-ranking officer, felt that he had failed. I mean, he was very hard on himself. And his book, Defeat into Victory, in a sense, begins, although it's his memoir, intellectually, it begins with him sitting after the Tamu campaign, trying to assess why he had failed. And not many great commanders would start from the position that I have failed, what do I need to do? But that's what he did. And he had that ability. It wasn't just Slim the soldier that we've talked about. It was Slim the man. He was without ego. I mean, you know, Montgomery had a pretty good understanding of soldiers, but Montgomery was also afflicted with this enormously fragile ego and this huge arrogance. And Slim wasn't burdened by any of that. I mean, he was a very impressive man, as well as being a very impressive general and an impressive soldier.
Mike, you mentioned his injuries. I just want to play you another part of our personal tour of artifacts with Viscount Mark Slim.
His dispatch case that he took everywhere with him, it had his correspondence in it, it had all sorts of things in it. I've got this wonderful 14th Army telephone directory, which was for the staff, which has Grandad at the top. His number was Mudford 9. And then I found a quite extraordinary thing in here. This is his compass box, but it doesn't have a compass in it. It has a bullet from a Fiat fighter, an Italian fighter. And at the beginning of the Second World War, four of these went through his backside from an Italian fighter. They are big and they are heavy. They were spent, of course, otherwise he wouldn't have survived. But he picked one of them up off the ground as he was being put on the stretcher and taken away. And he spent 10 weeks lying on his tummy. He was very severely wounded.
Wow. Well, it's a measure of the man, isn't it, that he could take that kind of punishment and come back. I mean, he was so resilient. He was so indefatigable, really. You know, he had enormous capacity for concentration, for detail, and for sheer hard work and determination. I mean, you'd expect that, I guess, in a senior officer. But I mentioned earlier, you know, not many in the Second World War especially, the politicians in London were often very quick to change generals if things didn't go perfectly well very quickly. The Desert Campaign, of course, was famously afflicted by this. And for some reason, Slim escapes. Maybe that's because it was a little bit of the forgotten army. Churchill and Alan Brooke sometimes kind of gossiping about him and criticising him behind his back. But there's never really an attempt to get rid of him. I think that's right, isn't it, Rob?
Yeah, exactly right. There was an attempt, two attempts to get rid of him in 1942 and 1944, but not in London. London was very, very supportive of Slim. And in that respect, Alan Brooke, who was chief of the Imperial General Staff, who had, so far as I can work out, never met Slim, nevertheless saw the enormous strength of his generalship from a great distance, and was very, very strongly supportive of him.
And he had quite a good relationship with Mountbatten, didn't he? Because he needed Mountbatten to intervene to get the logistics. You know, there's a big, there's all this arm wrestling going on about aircraft and ships. And often they need to get the Americans to help. And the Americans are a little bit suspicious of British motives and so on and so forth. But he was quite the diplomat, as well as being the friend of the ordinary soldier.
And one of the extraordinary things about Slim was that actually he, above him as the 11 Army Group commander, was General Sir George Gifford, who was a kindly old gentleman, says Slim in his memoirs, but he was his boss. And yet the reality is the core relationship in 14th Army was not between Slim and Gifford, and then subsequently Sir Oliver Leese, who had been commander of the 8th Army, but as you quite rightly say, Phil, between Slim and Mountbatten. And there's some very, very interesting reports that were sent back from SEAC, which Mountbatten commanded in 1945 to London, that had Mountbatten's signature. But actually, if you go into the 14th Army files, there are the letters that Slim wrote to Mountbatten that are copied then word for word from Mountbatten to Alan Brooke. So Mountbatten absolutely trusted Slim, and that was where the core relationship in the 14th Army and SEAC existed.
So, Mike, a man with integrity, a man who's clearly very thoughtful, picking up a bullet after he's been targeted, and from his humble beginnings and his experiences in World War One, both arguably this contributed to what was seen as a very different attitude towards the men under his command.
Yeah, he understood them. I mean, and that's one of the things that George MacDonald Fraser says that we mentioned early on. He said, you know, Slim, he when he comes to speak to the men, he said there was no jumping up on ammunition boxes, no barrack room slang to try to get on side of the men. He said he spoke straightforwardly. He stood with his carbine slung over his shoulder and his thumb hooked through the sling of his carbine, and he just spoke, and he just told them what was going to happen. And in a way, I always think that those sort of discussions that he had with his men, he was speaking to them with the strategic vision of their commander, but the honesty of their platoon sergeant. And that was the point. And they just believed him. And that was the thing. They believed in him and he believed in them. And that's a sort of implicit social contract between a commander and the followers. And that social contract is very hard to specify. It's quite hard to achieve, but it's a really strong bond. You believe in them and they believe in you as the commander.
Well, this seems like the perfect moment to pause and hear from a veteran who served under Bill Slim in the 14th Army in Burma, George Durrant, who is now 101 years old.
Oh, General Slim, he was marvellous. I met him up on the borders of Afghanistan when he came to visit us, and he had Vera Lynn with his side, so she sung a song to us.
What was it about General Slim that was so admirable?
Well, he was so particular and so very special. I don't know how else to explain it, but he was really wonderful at his job.
And he really valued his troops, didn't he?
He did, yes. Oh, yes. We had great faith in him. We know that he was one of the best leaders we could probably have. You should wake up in the morning and think, oh my God, here we go again, there's no escape. Main thing is, was all the damn snakes. I've never known so many snakes could be in one place at a time. You had to be really careful, especially putting on your boots, because I hide inside. I can't remember how many hundreds of snakes I must have killed, because I always had my Gurkha cookery knife hanging by my side, and every time I saw a snake, I would cut it in half. Conditions were terrible. The main problem was that damn sun. It just would not go away, and there was no escape. The only thing is, when the monsoon came, that was wonderful. You'd strip off to your underpants and go out and stand in the pouring rain, and that was wonderful. But it didn't last for long. The Japanese were very good at camouflage, so you had to be careful all the time. They were really marvellous how they could hide themselves. So we had to be as good as we could to kill them. So I used to kill them. I can't remember how many of them I killed, but it was quite a lot. Because if you don't kill them, they will kill you. That was the only way you could look at it.
Robert, really precious to get that kind of testimony, isn't it?
It's lovely hearing him describe his commanding general. This is not his brigade commander, his divisional commander, or his corps commander, but the commander of the entire army with such affection. And I've heard it from many, many veterans as well. And that meant that they all felt that they were fighting in a terrible war. It was a terrible war. The circumstances of fighting the Japanese was bloody and brutal in the extreme. The conditions, as George describes, the monsoon, although that sounded as though it was a relief, the monsoon drops about 300 inches a year in 5 months between October and November of a year. Very, very hard to be able to fight through that. But he captures the horrible conditions with all those jolly snakes. They come out with the rain. And the terribleness of fighting this very cunning, resourceful, ruthless, formidable enemy. Fabulous.
What do you take away from hearing that, Phil?
Well, actually, he touches on the common enemy that both the Japanese and the British-led army had, which was the jungle itself, and of course, disease caused by the heat, caused by the mosquitoes, caused by scrub typhus, dysentery. And this was a common problem. And one of the great things that Slim and Slim's army did was revolutionize military medicine. One of the characters in my book is a nurse in this campaign. And I call it a lavatorial revolution. But that sounds kind of slightly comic. But, you know, getting the rates of dysentery down was really important. And being able to give people really good hospital treatment when they were injured was really important. Penicillin is coming in. There's a whole series of innovations that mean that by 1945, the 14th Army soldier has got care when he's ill or when he's injured that is nothing so much better than the Japanese. Mm. And that really is one of the big dividing points between the two armies, that we're fighting the jungle better than the Japanese are, as well as fighting the Japanese better than we used to.
Yeah, and Mike, did the British have any experience of jungle warfare up until this point?
Not really. I mean, not in the period of the 20th century. A little bit in Africa, in West Africa, a little bit in the First World War. But I mean, that was the problem that they had. There was this sense that, you know, the jungle was an impossible environment to fight in, and Slim wouldn't have that. He sent, you know, he sent the 14th Army as he was building them into the jungle on exercises for long periods, so they'd stop fearing it. And this sense that, you know, the Japanese were uniquely able to fight in the jungle, that wasn't true either, because the Japanese were good because they moved so lightly equipped and with so little supplies, because they calculated on stealing the supplies, getting hold of the supplies from the forces that they overran. So if they were unable to overrun the forces, if the supplies were all locked in the middle of the admin box in Slim's tactics, then the Japanese would just have to go hungry. And that was what happened, is that the Japanese would throw themselves at these admin boxes with the desperation of starving men, which is what happened eventually to the 15th Army. By the time the 15th Army, Kimura's army, withdrew, they were completely emaciated because they'd simply run out of supplies. And Slim had this sense that if you kept the supplies, in a sense, with the bait, you know, keep them in the admin box in the middle, let the Japanese keep attacking them, they would be the anvil on which they would break themselves in useless attacks. And that was a kind of risky strategy, but my goodness, it worked. And it was right for the jungle. And I mean, as Phil said, I mean, he made the army, you know, almost understand the jungle. He reduced, I mean, the 14th Army, well, the old Eastern Army had, 70% casualties to ill health, to dysentery and malaria when he took it over. It was down to less than 5% by the time they'd got to Mandalay in 1945. So he dealt with all of that. And they produced, you know, parachutes, they called parajutes, made out of jute, because they were cheaper. They could produce hundreds of thousands of cheap parachutes to drop supplies. They were good enough for supplies, not good enough for men, but they were good enough for supplies. I mean, they created tar-covered hessian as road surfaces to build their own roads when they needed to. I mean, the 14th Army was a fabulous engineering army because, you know, Slim worked out, and his officers worked out, ways of operating in the jungle. And when we talk about the jungle, you know, thinking about novels as we have, or memoirs rather, as we have done, Spencer Chapman wrote a very good book, The Jungle is Neutral. And that was his experiences in Burma. The jungle is neutral. And it is. It's not to be feared. It's neutral. And you can get through it in the ways that Slim was able to train the 14th Army so to do.
Robert, in your lecture to the National Army Museum, you argue that Slim's approach to warfare underpins modern British military doctrine. So where do we see it now? Give us some examples.
Well, it's really an approach to war that says the best way of defeating an enemy is to identify his weaknesses and to exploit them mercilessly. There is a natural predilection, I think, in soldiers throughout history to use their military force to attack the enemy's force directly. The enemy's got 100 tanks, I need 120 in order to beat him. Slim proved that theory to be complete nonsense. He said the best way to kill a tank is to attack its fuel bowsers. And today we call that doctrine maneuver warfare. It's not necessarily about moving, although it does include that. It means about thinking about how best to move your forces to a point of advantage over the enemy. And it's good doctrine. It's good practical stuff from an infantry section when I was an infantry commander. This is exactly what you did. You tried to identify the best ways of overcoming the enemy. And you do that at brigade, divisional, corps and army level as well. Slim did this intuitively. I mean, I've argued in the past that he was never a theoretician of war. He didn't write like Little Heart or J.F.C. Fuller. He didn't write big books on doctrine, but he practiced it in battle against the Japanese. And Mike was talking earlier about this fantastic battle of Mandalay and Mactila in 1945. It just brought out all these virtues perfectly. Slim persuaded Kimura that he was going to fight on the northern side of the Irrawaddy. He didn't. Half of his army he sent to the south, and he attacked Kimura's weak underbelly, and it completely discombobulated the Japanese. And Kimura himself, after the war, said it was the key strategic masterstroke of the Second World War. We've forgotten that. The Japanese didn't forget it. They were quite impressed with Slim.
Yeah, and Mike, that's what you cited as one of the deceptions that the greatest of all that Bill Slim actually conducted.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't go through it again. I mean, Robert's just described it, really, except to say that Kimura, first of all, set up a trap for Slim. As he was approaching Mandalay from the north, Kimura tried to lure him into a trap, and Slim was initially tempted, and then he realised it was a trap, and he did a double bluff. So he pretended that he was falling into the trap. He sent one corps to the north in a noisy diversion, as if he was falling into the trap. Then he crossed the Irrawaddy further south in a genuine crossing, which was pretty expensive, but nevertheless got across. But the real crossing was 70 miles further south to Mektila, and he sort of came at Mandalay from the south. But what was the essence of all of that was that he let Kimura think that his trap was working. And so it was a double bluff.
And Phil, we mentioned a little bit earlier about how important Slim's approach was in commanding a very diverse army in the 14th, made up of many different nationalities and backgrounds. How did he achieve that?
I think he was known. It's funny, I spent a bit of time recently with a man who's been all over the media in the last few days, Yavar Abbas, who is a 104-year-old veteran of Slim's army, and actually knew my hero, General Timmy, and knew him personally. It's an extraordinary thing to, when you've written a book about somebody, he's been dead a long time, you meet somebody, you knew him, who happens to live about five bus rides away at Feltham, which is extraordinary. But he wasn't always very positive about some of his own commanders. He said they couldn't wait to get them out of the country, you know, because they were all quite passionate about independence. But he felt that Slim was different because he just didn't have any kind of side of kind of racial prejudice. He seemed to be like a man of the future. He saw him as somebody who was more concerned about winning a war than protecting the Raj. And he just managed, whether it was sincerely meant or not, he managed to persuade those Indian troops and African troops that he was their general too. And that it wasn't noblesse oblige or condescension. He was of the Indian army and loved it. It loved its traditions and loved its men. And of course, most of those men were Indians. And we shouldn't forget, all volunteered. All of them were volunteers, biggest volunteer army, I believe, in history. Yeah. And many of them were tempted to follow Bose. Some of them did, but almost all of them didn't. And that's to a large degree because they trusted Slim.
Yeah.
And given how bad things had been in 1942, that's an amazing achievement.
Yeah.
You know, 42, there is the Quit India campaign, the biggest act of insurrection against the Raj, really, since 1857. And yet, even after that, and after the Bengal famine too, Slim manages to motivate all these many hundreds of thousands of Indians to trust him and believe in him. And as I discovered with Captain Abbas, they still do.
Let's just collect some final thoughts from all of you. And the keys to his success. What, to you, is the most important single lesson today's military commanders could and should learn from General Slim? Can I ask you, first of all, Robert Lyman?
Oh, what a question. Well, the essence of Slim's success was he was able to identify spiritual, material and intellectual reasons for fighting the Japanese and persuading his Indian and African British soldiers that what they were fighting was right. They were on the right side of history, that the army that he, Slim, would support them every way he could. And they weren't on their own, even though they felt a long way away from home. And that they would work out ways of defeating the Japanese. They could get better at it. So those three things are fundamental. And every general needs to have them in his knapsack or her knapsack.
Well, hard to follow what Rob said. Persistence, imagination, empathy. I think of all those things, maybe persistence is the most important. You know, he kept going through all these disappointments and always with a positive idea of where he was taking his men. And eventually they came to buy into that vision, believe in that vision, and they then would proselytize for it themselves. So yeah, you spread good vibes, to use the modern expression, through your units, through the officers, through the men, through the NCOs, by a permanent example of persistence and optimism yourself. And he did that very, very well.
Mike, the most important single lesson today's military commanders could learn from General Slim.
Yeah, it comes down to the nature of that army, really. I mean, the 14th Army was the last, the biggest and the most successful of all Britain's imperial armies. So, you know, a million men from 20 different nations, 100 different languages, 30 different meal plans every day. And that army became an army that was well commanded. So the lesson was to create an army which can be led in the way it deserves to be led.
This has been a fascinating conversation. I thank you all very much for your time. Thank you, Mike, Dr. Robert Lyman and Phil Craig. That is all for now. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. Before then, head to the BFBS Forces News YouTube channel. There you can watch Tim Cooper's full personal tour with Viscount Slim of General Slim's artifacts. And we'll leave you now with one final artifact from that tour, a copy of Field Marshal Sir William Slim's memoirs, Defeat into Victory, from me, Kate Chabot. Bye-bye.
About 9 months before my grandfather died, I went into his drawing room in Windsor Castle, and he was sitting at his desk. I'd been asked to go in to see him, and he had this book, and he finished writing a letter to me inside this book, and then he stuck it in his book and gave it to me. And it says, it's dated the 30th of March, 1970. And it says, Mark, when I was a boy, I always wanted to be a soldier, and after many years, I became a general. I wrote this book, and when you grow up, you will perhaps read it to see what it was like to be a general in war. With my love, Granddad.